the government runs into more trouble with the judge at Senator Ted Stevens' trial. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, the 8th of October. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Lance Mackey adjusts to national stardom.
Milwaukee, Wisconsin, been to Michigan, been to Ontario. It's been crazy. Yeah, we've been around a little bit. Las Vegas, Reno.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
BP, proud to support public broadcasting in Alaska.
The Alaska Supreme Court heard arguments in the lawsuit by five legislators to stop the issuing of a report this Friday concerning the investigation of the Walt Monaghan firing by Governor Palin. The suit was determined to have no merit by the Superior Court. It was then elevated to an expedited Supreme Court hearing this afternoon. APRN's Dave Donaldson is at the courthouse where the hearings have just concluded. Dave, what were the arguments?
The arguments were that, first of all, Attorney Kevin Clarkson, who's representing the legislators, argued that you're not asking the Supreme Court to declare that the legislature cannot hear or do an investigation of this sort. He's asking them to rule instead that this particular investigation is unconstitutional and it has been done improperly with bad process. He's saying that, I don't know how this went over the court, but one thing I quoted him earlier is he says, even a five-year-old understands this, that they didn't react. But he said that basically the legislature did not follow its own rules. It did not have the investigative powers directly to have this investigation carried out, and that the committee really had no authority to do an investigation as it's been done. There have been an awful lot of procedural errors that Mr. Clarkson had seen and had said, that those things should be at the hands of the Supreme Court to rule whether the procedure has been followed, not the legislature itself to rule on its own procedures. And so that was that was what he was asking. The other side, argued by Peter Mawson before the legislative group, and he is not directly hired by the legislative council. He is there on a separate contract. But, he's saying it is that the legislature is encouraged to investigate the executive branch. That's the basis of the checks and balances system. And he's saying that, if you wish to keep this separation of powers doctrine that's written into the Constitution, it's a basic part of it, that it is interference of that doctrine is to rein in the legislature, particularly to avoid the challenging of the executive branch during a political campaign. And he referred directly to the governor's involvement in the national campaign for vice president.
Dave, were all the Supreme Court justices on hand to hear this case?
No, Justice Dana Fabe was not present. I did not know that until they actually walked in, and we don't know whether she was absent or put herself aside from the case or... I just don't know. She was not present. There were four of them present.
And Dave, were you able to get any sort of a read or any sense of which way the justices may be leaning?
No, I did not get a sense of it. I mean, I just don't know the dynamics of this court. I don't know the individual personalities that to know. I do know that they were asking questions of both sides, that there was a pretty good involvement, and that they were giving the impression that they were open on the decisions and that they were not accepting or rejecting any of them out of hand.
The justices have said they will make their decision by tomorrow afternoon. The report by Special Investigator Steve Branchflower is expected to be given to the Legislative Council on Friday. Judge Emmett Sullivan ruled this afternoon not to dismiss the case against Senator Ted Stevens, but there will be penalties for government prosecutors who the judge said used evidence they knew to be false. APRN's Libby Casey reports from Washington.
Government prosecutors say oilfield services company Veeco spent around $188,000 renovating Senator Stevens' Girdwood home. Included in that estimate are months Veeco employees spent working on the house. Prosecutors entered into evidence early in the trial timesheets that showed two men, Rocky Williams and Dave Anderson, consistently working at the Stevens house from the fall of 2000 to the spring of 2001. But Judge Emmett Sullivan says that evidence will now be thrown out. Here's why. Prosecutors had information that contradicted the number of hours the two men worked in Girdwood, and they didn't turn it over to Stevens' lawyers until after the trial started. Dave Anderson testified to a grand jury that during the Girdwood months, he left Alaska for 7 weeks. And Rocky Williams told FBI agents he worked on other projects for Veeco during that time, too. The defense said the double dose of new information was enough to warrant throwing out the case. Judge Sullivan ruled Wednesday that the trial will go on, but minus the evidence, and the jury will hear a statement that prosecutors presented evidence to jurors they knew was not true. Judge Sullivan was furious at the prosecutors, but they argued the information wasn't crucial to the case because their number of $188,000 is just an estimate. They say no matter what, Veeco workers put in lots of hours at the Stevens house, and Stevens never paid for it. That wasn't the only bump prosecutors hit Wednesday. The judge also ruled evidence and testimony are out about an automobile swap between Stevens and Veeco CEO Bill Allen. Allen gave Stevens a Land Rover for a Mustang and $5,000, which prosecutors say was a sweetheart deal for the senator. Stevens' lawyers tried to show this week that Allen was lying about the price he originally paid for the Land Rover at a dealership, but then the prosecution revealed the check for Allen's stated amount. The defense team said they should have gotten that check before cross-examining Allen. Judge Sullivan agreed, and on Thursday morning, the jury will hear the judge say that the government had an obligation to produce all material evidence to the defense and failed to do so. The rulings came at the end of a long day in court, during which jurors saw Stevens' Senate financial disclosure forms from 1999 through 2006. He had to declare any gifts worth over about $280. On them, gifts from world leaders like the King of Jordan and the French president, but nowhere were the names Veeco or Bill Allen. Jurors also saw scores of emails between Stevens and his friends mentioning gifts the prosecution says Stevens received, mostly from Veeco and Allen. The emails talk about Veeco workers being at the Girdwood house, and Stevens says they're doing a great job. While Stevens is in Washington, his neighbor Bob Persons ticks off the progress on stairs, a deck, concrete work, and steel work. Stevens writes an email about asking Bill Allen to install a generator and thanks Bob Persons for shipping a massage chair to his house that Stevens describes as a loan, but also calls a godsend that he enjoys sleeping in. Some emails and letters show Stevens asking Allen and others for invoices on the Girdwood house, but prosecutors tried to show that the attempt to get bills wasn't followed through on. The slew of emails and letters gets to the heart of the government's case, that Stevens knew what was going on in Girdwood and didn't pay for it. Prosecutors are expected to rest their case on Thursday. Then it will be Stevens' lawyer's turn to try and show the jurors that Stevens didn't know about the gifts, didn't want the gifts, and never lied on his Senate forms. They plan to start calling witnesses. At the top of the list, former Secretary of State Colin Powell and Senator Daniel Inouye of Hawaii. In Washington, I'm Libby Casey.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a daughter searches for clues about a father she only briefly knew.
This story hopefully will help other people to love one another, to forgive one another, to hold every day precious.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Alaska Quarterly Review is recognized as one of the nation's best literary magazines. Among the features of the 2008 issue is Joshua Castile's play, Returns, about the war in Iraq from Castile's unique perspective as an interrogator and Arabic interpreter at Abu Ghraib Prison. Copies are available at select bookstores or by subscription. Alaska Quarterly Review is edited by Ronald Spatz and published by the University of Alaska Anchorage. This message sponsored by UAA.
The Coeur d'Alene Mines Corporation has rejected a call for talks aimed at reviving a mine waste plan the company abandoned last month. The Southeast Alaska Conservation Council invited the Kensington Mines owners and federal regulators to resolve their differences yesterday. KTOO's John Ryan reports from Juneau.
SEAC wants to clear up an apparent misunderstanding between Coeur and the Environmental Protection Agency. The mining company says EPA's recent requests for more information on a plan to dispose of mine waste in paste form would cause too much delay. EPA officials have said they don't want to delay the opening of the Kensington mine. Coeur withdrew its application to dispose of tailings paste last month, and last week it announced layoffs of half the mine's 82 employees. Yesterday, SEAC invited Coeur and EPA to take part in independently facilitated talks on the paste plan. SEAC organizer Rob Cadmus says he doesn't know why Coeur abandoned the paste plan.
It's better for the environment. It'll get people back to work quicker. And so the concept is to get folks at the table, talk through these things, and see if some resolution can be worked out.
Coeur d'Alene Mine spokesman Tony Ebersole says the company appreciates SEAC's interest in getting the mine open, but
proceeding with the paste tailings plan is not a direction the company can embrace. As we have stated, we are awaiting the decision of the Supreme Court, and that's all we have to comment on at this time.
Can you say why you don't want to embrace the paste plan direction?
No, I'm sorry, John. That's all we have to say right now.
Coeur is waiting for the U.S. Supreme Court to rule whether the company's preferred plan to dump tailings in Lower Slate Lake violates the Clean Water Act. The earliest the court would hear the case is January. A decision is expected by June. In Juneau, I'm John Ryan.
The world's financial jitters haven't yet translated into a credit crisis for small business in Alaska. One bank chief says institutions still have plenty of money. Even so, fewer people are asking for loans. KTOO's Weld Royal has the story.
The credit crunch has made it harder for many lenders across the nation to raise capital. That means they have less money to give out. Craig Dahl is CEO of Alaska Pacific Bank. It's the state's smallest bank and headquartered in Juneau. Dahl says his bank's credit standards haven't changed and the bank still has cash available for borrowers, but applications for loans have dwindled.
We've seen a slowdown in demand for loans over the past quarter. I would say the first half of the year was tracking pretty much on schedule, but I think we've definitely seen a slowdown in demand by virtue of everyone looking at the current market conditions and wanting to make sure we all know where we're going over the next few months.
The bank's commercial customers include fishermen, grocery store, and gas station owners. It also offers mortgages and other consumer products. Alaska Pacific Bank handles many loans backed by the Small Business Administration and last year was named an SBA Community-Based Lender of the Year. SBA-backed loans to Alaska companies fell 18% this year compared to last. Dahl says Alaskans have been rattled by the crisis on Wall Street and they wonder how it will affect them. He believes the $700 billion bailout package passed into law last week will help restore confidence in the financial system. People have come into Alaska Pacific branches asking if their money is safe. He says staff has worked to reassure customers their accounts are protected and have put out new information on Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation rules.
We've had lots of inquiries from customers, which is kind of the last several years, no one's paid a lot of attention to FDIC coverage. First of all, we made sure that all of the appropriate brochures were in ample supply around our lobbies and made sure all of our staff were up to speed.
Alaska Pacific Bank itself has been affected by real estate turmoil in the lower 48. For the quarter ending in June, the company reported a loss of $761,000. That compares to a profit of $281,000 for the same period last year. Dahl says the loss is a result of three problem loans for real estate developments in which the company took part. Because of them, the bank has a bit less money to lend.
The rule is a bank cannot lend more than 15% of its capital. You could do the math on any institution and say if one day they had $100 million in capital, their lending limit would be X. And if the next quarter they had $90 million in capital, their lending limit would go down.
Dahl says Alaska Pacific remains well capitalized and its Alaska loan portfolio is performing satisfactorily. The company's stock price is trading at around $12 a share. That's less than half its high mark of $26 late last year. In Juneau, I'm Weld Royal.
Petersburg's public cold storage broke even and then some last fiscal year. In its second year of operation, the Petersburg Economic Development Council facility has also attracted some new customers. And despite a poor pink salmon return, the cold storage kept its blast freezers busy with chums for several weeks this summer. KFSK's Matt Lichtenstein reports.
The public cold storage not only paid for its own operations in the last fiscal year, it actually turned a small profit. The last fiscal year ran from July 2007 to July 2008. 2007 was the facility's first full summer of operations. Petersburg Economic Development Council Coordinator Liz Cabrera says the cold storage has exceeded her expectations.
I was really pleasantly surprised. You know, I thought it was going to be really close, and it worked out to be a little bit better end of the year picture than I thought it would be.
Cabrera says the cold storage brought in about $180,000 in revenue from last July to this July. That's about $15,000 over expenses. The nonprofit PEDC receives up to $150,000 in city funding each year to support its entire economic development program. But Cabrera says none of that money went to the cold storage this last fiscal year, since the facility more than paid for itself with its own revenue. When the current fiscal year ends next summer, the numbers may not be quite as good considering this year's poor pink salmon returns. The facility's anchor tenant, Trident Seafoods, did not have surplus pink salmon to freeze like it did last year, but it did freeze a lot of chum salmon, and Cabrera says she was impressed with how much the cold storage was able to do.
We did over 1 million pounds just in the month of July of chums, which it took us almost all summer to do that many last year. So as far as efficiency and being able to increase the capacity, we really improved on that side. But then when it came time for pinks to show up, and we all know that they didn't really show, they didn't have a surplus amount of pinks here at Trident to run through the facility.
Cabrera says the cold storage ended up blast freezing about 1.4 million pounds of chum this summer. Last summer, the facility froze about 1 million pounds of chum and another 900,000 pounds of pink salmon. The facility is also attracting new users besides Trident and other seafood processors.
And I think people are just figuring out now, you know, how to use the facility. So not only are we getting the seafood processing companies, but we're also getting local restaurants and grocery stores that are interested in using it. So that's really rewarding to see.
The extra revenue that the cold storage brought in during the last fiscal year could help the facility through the current fiscal year, since business was leaner this summer. Pink salmon returns are expected to improve next year, so Cabrera is optimistic the cold storage will continue to support itself.
The facility is really, I think, running as about as efficient as it can. It's on the blast freezing side. You know, I would think that next year, assuming a good return, that, you know, it would do really well.
Cabrera says the PEDC is also considering expanding its services to include bait, maybe having some bait on hand to sell to processors or directly to fishermen. In Petersburg, I'm Matt Lichtenstein.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Grant Station, finding grants for nonprofit organizations, schools, and governmental agencies throughout the U.S. and Canada. Grant Station, fast track to funding. On the web at grantstation.com.
And by
Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, an Alaskan company providing lifting and rigging products since 1983. On the web at arcticwirerope.com.
Reigning Iditarod and Yukon Quest champion Lance Mackey of Fairbanks is in New York City to promote the Discovery Channel's new TV series on The Last Great Race. Mackey is one of six mushers profiled in the six-part reality show. Mackey describes the intense coverage of last year's Iditarod by Discovery as a worthwhile distraction.
At times, it's a little kind of an inconvenience, we'll put it that way. But it's necessary for this sport to grow and be recognized for what it is. We need the in-depth coverage and the, you know, the media right there in your face and getting the true, real stories, you know?
The first episode of the Discovery Iditarod series debuts on cable and satellite television October 14th. Mackey's scheduled to be on the Conan O'Brien show Thursday night and possibly other talk programs to promote the series during his four-day stay in New York. The trip is one of many Mackey has made to fulfill promotional obligations in recent months.
I've been to L.A. a couple of times. I've been to Milwaukee, Wisconsin. I've been to Michigan, been to Ontario. It's been crazy. Yeah, we've been around a little bit. Las Vegas, Reno.
Mackey says he keeps his promotional stints to a few days at a time so as not to interfere too much with training. He says he's been running teams behind four-wheelers since mid-August, doing much of the training himself with the help of a teenage son, but that two handlers will soon join the operation. Mackey says the money and prizes from his string of Iditarod and Quest wins have made his life easier, but he's still hungry to race.
That doesn't take away from my motivation and my desire to still want to win because I still need a new truck.
Mackey says he hopes the Discovery Iditarod will show brings in more sponsors as he anticipates another intense and costly season of competition. He says he plans to have a team in all the season's major distance events, starting with the Jinjin 200 in Paxson in December. Nobel laureate and atmospheric scientist Michael Schlesinger recently made the rounds in Alaska. The University of Illinois professor is a contributor to the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which won the 2007 Nobel Prize. He sat down with KBBI's Emily Schwing.
The title of Dr. Schlesinger's presentation was Climate Change 101, Hard Truths You Should Know, and Schlesinger says there's no better place than Alaska to experience climate change firsthand.
The temperature increase in the Arctic and in Alaska is about 50% larger than the average temperature. And that's because the Arctic is an ocean covered by sea ice surrounded by land. And when you warm the climate, you melt the sea ice. So what is happening first here.
Only about 24% of exposed land in the northern hemisphere is dominated by permafrost, and only about 10.5% of the Earth's surface is dominated by sea ice. But Schlesinger says it's these regions that will likely undergo the most dramatic changes due to a warming climate.
I mean, with global warming, what happens is not only plants but animals, they have a range in terms of temperature and precipitation, and they will try to go where they're comfortable and where they can live and where they can eat. So species will basically move poleward and upward. And it's kind of like having people from the lower 48 come over and start living in Alaska and pushing the Alaskans farther north.
Dr. Schlesinger says there's no doubt that climate change is indeed human-caused, but he says it's an inadvertent disturbance.
By increasing greenhouse gases at the beginning of the industrial age, we unknowingly left a legacy of climate change for 40 generations of human beings.
Schlesinger argues that now that we understand the negative impacts of fossil fuels, we have an opportunity to change our habits.
We should put in a standard of the amount of electricity required to generate a certain amount of illumination. So this would stimulate innovation and development of technologies and putting in standards for emissions from basically coal-fired power plants and basically putting in the California rules for emissions from automobiles.
But Schlesinger says he is wary about how effective habitual changes can be, because he says the problem is geopolitical in nature.
If the developed nations completely shut off the emissions and the developing nations develop as the developed nations have, then game over. So in order to solve this problem, all of the major emitting countries have to reduce emissions, otherwise it doesn't work.
Nobel Prize-winning climate scientist Michael Schlesinger has spoken in Fairbanks and Anchorage. He spoke in Kodiak on Saturday. He spoke in Homer on Sunday. Reporting in Homer, I'm Emily Schwing.
Captain Eric Peter Jacobson was among the five who died when the Alaska Ranger sank last Easter in the Bering Sea. Since that day, his daughter Karen has been on a journey to find out more about the father she was only just beginning to know. KIAL's Ann Hillman spoke with Jacobson and the filmmaker who's trying to capture the story of the sea captain's daughter.
When Karen Jacobson was 9 years old, her father left his family behind and went to Alaska to work on fishing boats. As Eric Peter Jacobson worked his way up to captain, he focused on fishing and seldom visited his children on the East Coast. Though Karen was hurt by her father's neglect, when she was in her early 20s, she decided to find him again.
I think I was becoming bitter, you know, since I didn't see him and he didn't contact us that much. But like I said, he was kind of someone who spent a lot of time at work, work-orientated, and he was out to sea a lot. And I decided if I don't call him and try to arrange seeing him, I don't know if I'm going to see him again. So I just had to kind of swallow my pride, and I wanted to know my dad. And thank God, you know, I reconnected with him.
Over the next few years, they spoke on the phone, and she went to visit him once before they lost touch again.
I remember one time some time elapsed, and he said, you know, years like a day to him. He just loses track of time, but he always told me he loved me and my brother. But mostly I tried to keep in touch with him and pursued the relationship.
At the urging of a friend, Karen called her father in mid-2007 and reconnected once more. They spoke on the phone, joking and laughing. About 6 months later, after finishing Easter brunch, she received word that her father, the captain of the Alaska Ranger, went down with the ship.
You know, the sea took my father, and I don't have any regrets because, you know, I know I loved him, and I know that he loved me, and I had some time with him by mostly my own efforts.
She went to see him for the last time.
I expected him just to pop out of the casket and say, ooh, you know, because he was always like a jokester, you know, joking around and very energetic and didn't sit still too much, you know.
Since the funeral, Jacobson has been on a journey to find out more about her father. She's joined by her friend, amateur filmmaker Lisa Haggerty, and they're trying to piece together Captain Jacobson's life while facing the emotional challenges of making the story into a film.
I want to keep the camera running as a filmmaker, and as a friend, I want to shut it off and give her a hug, but I have to just use my discretion and then tell her ahead of time, hey, listen, you know, just know I'm capturing this because I want to, and I, you know, I love you, and I'll give you a hug afterwards, but we need to get this emotion, we need to capture these things.
They hope the tale of the sea captain's daughter will help others see the importance of forgiveness and letting go.
This story hopefully will help other people to love one another, to forgive one another, to just to hold every day precious, because we never know when something like this could occur.
Jacobson and Haggerty are still seeking funding and contacts for their film project. You can find out more through their website, www.alaskarangerfilmproject.com. In Unalaska, I'm Ann Hillman.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at aprn.org. We had reports tonight from John Ryan and Weld Royal in Juneau, Matt Lichtenstein in Petersburg, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Emily Schwing in Homer, and Ann Hillman in Unalaska. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Dave Donaldson from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. John Prophet is our webmaster. Our managing editor is Duncan Moon. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by the Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, operating and maintaining the Trans-Alaska Pipeline.
The 8th Annual Aviation North Expo is happening at the Fairbanks Princess Riverside Lodge October 16th through the 18th. This 3-day aviation conference features travel and lodging discounts, FAA certification, a trade show, and networking opportunities. For details and to register, visit aviationnorth.org or call toll-free 877-427-5599. This message sponsored by the Aviation North Expo.
APRN will be providing special coverage of the 50th anniversary of Alaska statehood. For sponsorship information, call 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.